In this episode, we answer your questions. We take a dive into inverted nipples and what you can do during pregnancy and with breastfeeding. We answer whether vaginal examinations are necessary during pregnancy, why milk teeth are called milk teeth. We look into informed non-consent in the hospital setting and discuss declining interventions during labour and birth. We delve into the ethics and copyright on how to share information on social media, whether you can or should breastfeed whilst pregnant, how placenta function is checked on an ultrasound scan and placenta previa, as well as fitting in why some women experience lower libido and vaginal dryness whilst breastfeeding, and the Kiko, knees in, calves out, birthing position. Phew, that was a lot, and we hope you enjoy it as always. And FYI, folks, we open this episode with a slight interruption from Rachel's husband. I couldn't cut this and put it at the end with the bloopers, as otherwise all his other little pop-ups throughout the show just wouldn't make sense. So, as you can see, we are being as professional as always when we do a podcast recording with just the two of us. Right, let's leap into this. My dear friends, the latest Cauldron episode, just for your waiting ears. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. All right, mate.
Hello.
You said what the fuck's happening with the picture?
Hello, Katie Bun. How are you?
Can you help me? I don't know what to do, like. It's happened three times. No, it's just me, I'm having a fucking rave.
I'll see you later, man.
All right, see you later. Thanks for coming on the podcast, like, Reedy. First appearance. You know this is staying in. You know it. Brilliant. Rachel does have a husband. It wasn't made up.
Could have been me doing that voice.
No, man, he's trying to compete.
He's back in there making a desk, so
thrills. We'll leave him to it. So all the background noise is desk building. Brilliant.
And the swearing and the talking to himself, hopefully we can't hear that.
Fabulous. I love how professional we are. This is just amazeballs. So, listener questions.
Right. What were we doing then?
Well, it was your idea to ask the listeners for questions.
Oh, like, blame me.
I'm totally blaming you. We had so many questions.
I know. Well, I said, let's do something easy because I haven't got time to prepare for an entire podcast.
So here we are, and we have got quite a lot of questions, and clearly we're not going to be able to get through all of them because there was so many. So we have condensed them down, listeners, and you may not hear your own question because we could possibly do about 25 podcasts with them. So we're going to try and do a mixture of you and me, Rachel. Just you
and the topics, like, so there was VBAC. Lots of people asking for VBAC. We will do a whole thing. We'll do a whole podcast on VBAC at some point. We're trying to capture somebody to do that with us. So that's
capturing
happening.
Them. I'm out with my butterfly net at the moment, like just hunting. So I feel
like that.
don't hunt butterflies, by the way, people. It's not good for their wings. Just so you know.
And there was requests about home birth. mm-hmm. which is like, so there's, it's really different across the world, because with that, you can't really talk about home birth without talking about the politics of home birth, because it's really different. Like, for example, in the UK, it's on the NHS. It's not in Australia. So it's, well, mostly not. So then you head into the politics of home birth, which then doesn't apply to a lot of other women having home births in different settings. And home birth itself is actually just birth. That's actually how birth has always been. So it's just physiological birth. So anyway, we might come back to that.
I think, I think there's a podcast in talking about the politics and why we have the problems, which would actually be really interesting. Also, if you are listening and you haven't listened to the Birth Time episode or watched the movie, then that would be a good place to start. Brills.
Yes. And of course, everybody asked about bloody induction. Honestly, I cannot get away from bloody induction.
Can you see that Rachel is in a very good mood this morning? I'm going to try and cheer her up. Not this morning, it's this evening for her. I mean, I've got a cup of tea and I'm quite happy because the sunshine is shining. The sunshine is shining. The clouds have moved. The sun is able to get through. The sun is always shining. Just whether you can see it or not. Oh, philosophical for this morning. Yep, she's really in a good mood, people. So, induction of labour, your favourite topic. You wrote a book on it, Rachel. What do you expect? That's all I'm saying.
We have talked about induction. We've done two podcasts, one of them with me. We covered, did we cover induction and gestational diabetes?
Yes, we did a whole episode on gestational diabetes and we covered it within that.
Yes, Sarah Wickham has written a more recent book than me on induction. And a lot of the questions that were asked are on Sarah's blog site, on my blog site, in our previous podcasts, or in Sarah or mine's books. So I'm not going to head back into induction tonight because I'm too grumpy, but I'm sure we'll revisit it at some point.
So induction of labour, I'm just going to soften the blow of that, is something that is extensively done. I do understand that a lot of people don't want to read. They want to just listen to us natter on about it on the hop. But go back to our other podcast, go and re-listen to Sarah and get both of their books because they are bloody awesome. And I find myself dipping into them really quite frequently, actually, because I need to, and just to refresh my brain. So, yeah, I'm just doing book plugs here because they are bloody awesome.
So do I, because I don't keep that. I don't keep that information in my head.
The stats.
That's why I wrote that book. And I've got Sarah's book as well that I
Me too. Use Is it regularly. Covered in highlight like all of your books are as well? It's just like highlight pen, highlight. And then I go, why did I highlight everything? Because it's just a massive highlighting. So I actually can't find anything. Now I do different page turning.
No, what I do is I have, if it's a good book, I have the paper copy and I have the Kindle copy because then I can go into the Kindle copy and I do all my highlights, search it and highlight in there.
F7. You told me that before. I need to get with the whole Kindle. I'm a paper lover. I'm a paper lover. Right. So induction of labour. The other thing was that there was quite a lot of questions on nuchal cords. And have we talked about this in a podcast or is it just that you've got a not just sorry is it that you have a blog post on that? Because I think it would be a good whole podcast, actually.
Well, I'm happy to do a whole podcast. Nuchal cords is what started my PhD. That was my question. All right, we'll put that on the list,
folks, because it's, I mean, Rachel is the queen of nuchal cords. Well, in my eyes she is, because I learned a lot from her about it. There goes her husband with another box. It's just fun and games. We should do video. I've been reading about how important it is to do video for podcasts, Rachel. And I was going to say to you, we're going to have to put, I'm going to have to sort my camera out for starters. And I'm going to have to put my face on in the morning. You'll have to wear clothes. Luckily, it's coming into winter for you guys. So
coming into winter. That's what my brother said as well. He said we have to do, because he knows all about podcasts. Yep.
I was reading a blog post yesterday that said, you know, often when you start, it was like this really famous blogger, podcaster person. Often when you start doing the video, it took me 20 hours to edit. on top of what I'm already doing. Oh, I was no. So then we'd have to have the uncut version, Rachel. Can you imagine? Me neither.
No.
I mean, it's bad enough. We've just spent 15 minutes waffling. So, and I'm not cutting it because we're late putting a podcast out. So just mind your words today.
Right, well, get on with the questions then.
Oh, God.
Right, you see, I'm going to ask you a question, but do you know what? I'm pretty sure we've answered this question before. I remember talking about this.
Don't ask it.
So keep the answer short.
Well, what
is
it?
Do you want me to ask it? All right. Do you want me to go on to the second question? It was your first question we have definitely talked about.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. Oh, I couldn't remember if we'd talked about that or not. Right. Well, I was going to talk to you first.
Why do I have to go first? You can go first. I'll ask you this question because I'm interested in this one as well. So, inverted and flat nipples, what's your opinion on the nipple everters? And shields?
Inverters. No, I don't want them to be more inverted. They're inverters. Right. Okay. So obviously a certain proportion of women will have flat nipples, which is quite self-explanatory, which is where the nipple doesn't protrude or evert. And there will be women who have nipples that actually go sort of in on themselves, inverted. But there's really only about 4 or 5% of women which have what we call true inverted nipples, which means that when you stimulate the nipple, it doesn't pop out, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of women who are pregnant might notice that, oh, I don't really have these sticky outy nipples, and can worry of how the breastfeeding is going to go. The thing is that every breast is different. I'm just singing all morning today. It's keeping me awake. It's early one. Every breast is different. Every nipple is different. So specifically here on a podcast, I can't say every woman with flat nipples and every woman with inverted nipples can do X to make sure that breastfeeding is fine. What I would say is that if you notice that during pregnancy, it's really good to talk to your midwife and I would say if you're seeing an obstetrician for your care, they more often than not haven't got specific breastfeeding training. So I would then see a private midwife or I would see a private lactation consultant to discuss this. And they'll be able to assess the breast and look at giving you some tips and tricks that you can try once baby is born. Now, babies have a super excellent sucking reflex. I mean, if anyone's ever put their finger in a baby's mouth, my goodness, they suck. I mean, if anyone's breastfed, my goodness, they can hang on, that's for sure. And so over time, the babies are able to draw nipples out. So longer term breastfeeding, we can find that mums who've had really flat nipples or inverted nipples, maybe with the second pregnancy, their nipples are much more pokey, pointy, coming out.
Pokey. Pokey nipples.
Pokey nipples. They're just going around poking everyone. Oi, do the washing up. Oh, what am I talking about? Jesus. So, yeah. But the biggest fear is obviously, will the baby attach? And I always see the nipple. Now, there's going to be people listening to this going, what is she talking about? But where the nipple sits is between the kind of hard and soft palate in the mouth when they're breastfeeding. So they really draw the nipple back far, and they take a lot of breast tissue into the mouth, hence why it's called breastfeeding and not nipple feeding. And this is often where the problems come in, is when we are just nipple feeding and obviously it's not in the right position. The tongue compresses the nipple. We can end up with soreness and cracks. So the nipple should sit between the hard and soft palate. And for me, when there is a nipple that's a pokey nipple, an outy nipple, it's a bit like, I imagine the nipple presses like a button, like a doorbell, and that sends the message to the baby to go, oh, it's on my palate, start sucking. So they recognize that there is the right amount of tissue and there's a nipple in their mouth. Now, this is purely my fantasy world of story of how I like to think about it. And what we find sometimes is with flat nipples or inverted nipples, even when we shape the breast tissue, for some babies, not all, they will go onto the breast, do a few sucks, and then they're just not getting this kind of message that
they're not getting the doorbell pressed.
They're not getting the doorbell pressed to start sucking. And so we find that they will go on, they come off, they go on, they come off. And so this is where things like nipple shields come into play, potentially. And like with anything that we introduce, it should be seen as a tool to get us to a place where we're fully breastfeeding. So it's a part-time tool for some mothers. But if you've got women who have true inverted nipples, they're really not going to come out. That's development during, as a fetus, like these muscle fibers are pulling this nipple in. And again, sometimes with long-term breastfeeding, that can then loosen this and they start to evert. But probably they're quite tough to breastfeed with. And these women will probably need a nipple shield, which I like to think of a bit like a thin silicone sombrero hat for your nipples. So I want to put the sombrero hat on. And then what that does is it allows the doorbell to be pressed in the palate and the baby goes, aha, and starts to suck. However, the thing with nipple shields is, once we put babies on them, of course, they get used to it. And so you need to make sure that you're seeing, you're in contact with your midwife, a breastfeeding clinic, a lactation consultant to wean the baby off. We have to kind of wean them off them. But like I say, some women will breastfeed the whole time with them because they need to. The other controversy with nipple shields is when to introduce them. Because if you think about at the very beginning, there's this very small amount of colostrum. And that might be just, you know, half a mil, 4 mils each feed on the first day, maybe even more. And then on the second day, it might be around 11 mils, depending on how well they're sucking, what type of birth this mother and labor this mother's had, and how well everything's functioning. But we know it's tiny amounts of quite a sticky, thick fluid. Does this get through the shield? That's the question. However, I'm always asking the question, and obviously as a lactation consultant, I'm looking at things on an individual level. So this is not a blanket statement here, but there are some mums where I will, the baby can't go on, we will express until she has larger volumes of milk, or we should see signs of her milk coming in. And then when the milk is flowing easier, we start with the nipple shield if we can't get this baby to feed. However, I have also started at the very beginning with the nipple shield, with lots of supervision, with someone who isn't just going to go off into the community with no support. And this is a really controversial topic to talk about. I'm sure there will be people maybe rolling their eyes at me, but I've used things like supply lines very early on with nipple shields if we've had greater weight loss. And this is a bigger, bigger topic. So what I'm saying is the ideal is to, if is the big question, if we need to use a nipple shield, wait until the milk is flowing easier. If you are working with a lactation consultant, they may introduce that earlier with supervision, with lots of other tips and tricks to go along, because I always ask the question, what is better in those early days, to get mum and baby together breastfeeding or to have separation, which is expressing, giving the baby by spoon feed or cup feed or syringe colostrum, and then waiting till day three, day four, possibly to put them together on the breast. The other question was these nipple everters, and there's makeshift ones for midwives, like, you know, we've been doing them with cutting the ends off syringes and turning them backwards to try and pull nipples out. You can get them from all different companies. The evidence for that is pretty slim. We haven't really seen that they've worked. And again, on an individual basis, I've worked with some women who've said, actually, this is really working. And other women who are like, what a waste of money, didn't do a thing. And that's really going to depend on the elasticity of your nipple. So where does that leave us? The research really says there's no point. I don't want you to hurt yourself during pregnancy. I don't want you to overstimulate yourself, and I don't want you to waste money, but it may be worth trying. The other thing is also to use the things we're born with just our hands and our fingers to stimulate, trying to bring the nipple out, but without being rough or painful during pregnancy or afterwards. So this is a very small, we could almost do a whole podcast just on the ins and outs of this, but that's a very small way of answering that question about pokey nipples or non-pokey nipples. And they're all beautiful, and don't call them pokey nipples. Answered? Happy?
Yep.
Right, Rachel, is there evidence that vaginal exams are necessary at any point during pregnancy? Ooh.
No.
Right, next question. I was hoping you'd do that.
No, why? Like, why? I know this has to have come from the US, because I think in the US they do quite a lot of vagina examinations, just auto reminds, like, all I imagine is vulvas sitting at desks doing exams. Like, in a exam.
I need to make a whole art installation of that. That's brilliant. Oh my God, my brain is now going, oh, I'm getting back on the clay. They're all going to be sitting at exam desks.
So I think this is right, because I know that in the US, there seems to be quite a lot of just doing them during pregnancy. I've never worked anywhere where it's a thing that you do in pregnancy. I can't understand why you would do that. There's no point. It doesn't tell you how close the woman is to labor. It's uncomfortable, and all it is grooming compliance for other interventions. It's just another, you know, me as the external expert's going to do an intervention that's quite uncomfortable to find out information that's absolutely pointless, and you're going to accept that. And it's just grooming the woman to carry on accepting that so that we can do that in labor. So no, that's the short answer.
Can I ask you a sideline question? Is there a danger to doing vaginal examinations in pregnancy?
Yeah, introducing infection, accidentally rupturing the membranes, pain, discomfort, make it bleed. Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons not to do it, and I can't think of one reason to do it.
Brilliant. Brilliant answer. Thank you. That should be clear. Right. Is it my turn?
It is.
Look at you looking with your glasses.
Because I'm reading the questions. Yeah, I've got to ask you. See how much quicker I was than you? Just saying. Anyway.
But mine wasn't like a one-word answer. There was like three parts to that. Be careful if you ask me the one you're going to ask me. Number four. Just saying. That's a really long one. That's the whole episode.
Okay, no.
So I don't even think we'll get through.
Well, all of these could be full episodes.
Well, there we go.
Do you want them in order, do you, or can I pick and choose?
You can pick and choose.
All right, well, I like this one. What's the natural weaning age?
Oh, we've talked about this, but I did read something that I was like, oh, I don't think I mentioned before. The natural weaning age is around 2.5 years to about 6 or 7 years. And we have talked about this on another podcast. But what is interesting is milk teeth, you know, the first teeth we get, are called milk teeth because we're still drinking milk from the breast while we have them.
Mm.
And then they fall out around the age of when we naturally wean as humans.
Wow.
I know. I was like, why did I not talk about that before? So there you go.
Yes. Excellent.
That was a quick answer. Done.
That was a quick answer.
Oh, it's you then. This is good. It's like a game.
Yep.
I have to keep scrolling up and down on the questions. Right. Yours are in order. So,
well, I don't mind if they're not, but they kind of make sense in that order.
That's great. I'm just more higgledy-piggledy, like the camera going higgledy-piggledy. Informed non-consent. If a birthing woman has no alternative to a hospital birth setting, say free birth, and limited choice of hospital, and has the confidence to decline a lot of interventions which are policy, what should be front of mind? How far can she and her support team push without suffering for the battle? And what difficulties might be unwittingly caused for midwives? Ooh.
Oh, you see, now that's a podcast.
Yes. What we might do, though, is expand on these as podcasts and we can give our shorter answers here.
Right. Good idea. All right. So first of all, it's very rare that things are policy in hospital. They're usually the hospital, what do they call them? Not guidelines. What do they call those things that they just make up? No. They're called directives, or like, so someone on the, you know, some obstetrician on the birth suite writes some directives that that's how this birth suite runs. That's kind of how it is. So they're very rarely policy. Right. So I would always ask, is something a policy or is this a guideline? Is this a what you're meant to do? Or is this actually a hospital policy? Because it's very rare to have a policy for anything other than things like protocols for preeclampsia treatment and things like that. So how far can, so I like think has the confidence to decline a lot of interventions, because there's actually not a lot of women do not have the confidence to decline a lot of interventions, particularly not when they're in that setting being maybe coerced with pressure and they're, you know, feeling vulnerable and outside their comfort zone. It's quite easy to not to lose your confidence. So how far can she and her support team push without suffering for the battle? That will entirely depend on who's on staff.
Yeah.
You know, you can legally push all the way. You can legally decline an intervention, even if it would mean that you would die. So, or your baby would die. So legally you can do that. Realistically, you might cop some pressure, some coercion, some, you know, bringing in more people to try and get you to do the thing that they want you to do.
Of course.
Which may, I don't know whether that's what they mean by suffering for the battle. So it's going to be a hard slog, which is why I actually think it's unrealistic to expect women to do that when they're in labor.
Absolutely.
Because it alters the physiology of labor, being in that fight mode. Yeah. You need to not be there. So you need to surround yourself. You are going into a setting where you know you're going to want to do things that are not aligned with the cultural norms in that setting. You need to go in with a very clear plan, preferably have given it to someone before you've gone into labor. So it's not an introduction that, hey, I want to do this thing that you don't like me doing. And have somebody there whose role is to advocate for you so you can just get on with birthing.
Absolutely.
And somebody else can do the, this is what she wants, it's in her notes, and advocate for you.
Would you advise that that would be someone who is trained as a birth worker, like a doula or a private midwife in particular?
I actually think it is easy when it's not somebody who is in the family, who's emotionally involved and invested in the outcome. It can be really difficult to advocate for somebody when you know, you don't know. And
no, and you're in it too. You're watching, which is actually a really hard place to be as the observer. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to be the battle keeper as well. It's
It's a big ask. And what difficulties might be unwittingly caused for midwives? Well, actually, that's not your problem. You know, women should not be going in to hospital worrying about the impact of any of their decisions on anybody apart from themselves. As part of the job of the midwife is to work with women who want all kinds of different things and to work with whatever it is that that woman wants. That's actually the midwife's job. And if she's copying it, because midwives do, you know, cop it from colleagues, they get bullied, they get all kinds of, that's actually not the woman's problem. That's the midwife's problem. So I used to actually say to women when I was looking after women in continuity of care scenarios where the woman was wanting to not do the thing that was the norm, women would often be really worried about the midwife and say, oh, but, you know, what about you? And it's like, and I would just say to them, look, you worry about you and making the decisions that are right for you. I'll worry about me. I'm a big girl. I can take care of myself. That's my stuff.
Yep. Yep. Brilliant. Is that a hormone of accommodation flowing through us?
Estrogen.
Yep. So great. Great answer. We did have some questions actually that were for both of us. One of those would have come in.
We did, and then you've missed them off this list.
Yeah, because you just put yours. Let me open.
All right, well, let's do a one that's in blue that's for both of us. Okay, so this is about somebody saying that they use social media to talk about birth and promote their childbirth education classes, but they're getting conflicting advice about...
I really hope that came up on the background. Is he all right? Has he dropped like something on his foot?
You're all right.
It's fucking heavy. Someone, it's really heavy in there.
Would you want me to help you?
No.
Sorry.
This is going to be the best podcast ever. You're in a crouch. I really scored. Really, are you all right, man? Are you all right? You're not.
I am all right, man.
All right. I'm glad your foot's still working, like.
I'm sorry, man.
Right. Now I've lost where I was at. So somebody was doing, right, childbirth education classes, and they're getting conflicting advice about what's okay when it comes to sharing things. So one person whose course I took told me it's okay to use other people's content and quotes and put it in my branding. Ooh. Mm-hmm. But then I read other stuff that says this isn't legal or ethical. So who's right? And where can midwives learn about all this stuff that seems to be expected now, but wasn't covered in midwifery training, which we actually don't cover that in midwifery training.
Maybe we need to cover that in midwifery training. Yeah.
We do. Well, we do have a little social media, how to use social media and not get yourself into professional trouble.
Yeah, but I think all companies have that, don't they? It's like mandatory training and everything. Well, in the hospitals it is.
All right. Well, so you want to answer that? Oh, yeah, I'm going to answer that as well.
Go on then. You could start with that. Oh, I mean, I agree with you. The caution is needed. If it's someone else's, if you're not saying where your source is from and you're not, so if you're quoting someone and you're putting it as with your own branding, then it's as if you're saying it from your own mouth. But if it's someone else's quote, you need to reference as you would if you were writing a paper and you would reference the authors of that paper. So you need to be citing things correctly. What someone's written, if it's a book or if it's on their website, is their copyright. And so we need to be really cautious with that, about saying who said it and where it's come from, is my answer to that.
So I think it's really difficult because in this era, it's just very quick kind of surface level skim share, which lends itself to, it's really hard, I think, for people to navigate. I've, you know, I have been in academia, which is all about this stuff, like all about citing references. You can't even make a statement without saying where you got the idea from.
You can't even say anything that you think, because it doesn't matter. It has to be someone else's words.
Yeah. So, and the whole law around that, and at uni in terms of teaching resources, you know, you can't just share something on the uni platform that's like, it's really kind of, you taught it. It's something that you have to live and breathe. Mm-hmm. And then writing a book, you know, there's copyright there. So you can use a certain amount of text from somewhere else, as long as you say where it's from, so the person can go back to find where it's from. So you're right. You just have to credit. And that's legal, but it's also ethical. You know, people spend a lot of time. For a lot of people, that is their living, is their writing, or they're creating something. And it's really important to acknowledge that. And that's, and when I was doing my online course, you know, it's really actually quite difficult. So I was, trying to find images to use, and women very kindly shared their birth pictures with me. So, you know, I had to then say in the course, don't share these outside of the course, because, you know, the women have given me permission to use their pictures in this course. I'm not happy about them then flying off, going wherever without the women knowing about it. But just images, you know, I was trying to just find graphics, and it was doing my head in. There are sites like Canva. You can get free, copyright free graphics. That's a great thing to be involved to get yourself
and
into.
And we're not being paid by them. Actually, we should have asked them to sponsor us. Bloody hell. Especially as we're talking about these things, because Canva is great.
Canva is good, and Splash as well. Yes. And then there's other places, and often the diagrams are really expensive. Mm. So I actually went on and I think I did a month, and then went, I'm not paying that much for diagrams, thank you very much, considering they're not even correct. So that's why I actually drew my own diagrams, because I couldn't find diagrams that were copyright free or that I could buy the copyright for to use my course that were correct, you know, in terms of physiology. Yeah. So I drew them. And then I thought, other people might want to use this, and it's my copyright. Yeah. So they can buy the pictures and my and the permission to use them.
So there's another little Rachel's got some diagrams. They're for sale. Go and buy them. They're for sale. Also, I'm going to employ you to do some diagrams for me for when I'm going to need them. So get your pen. But you're right. It is a bit of a minefield. And I think the biggest thing is just being really clear where you've got something from, and because that person's put effort and energy into whatever it is, podcast, book, film, course, it's time, it's energy, and it's often their business as well. I mean, this is my hobby, but still it's part of your business.
Yeah, and photographers as well. You know, that if you're sharing a picture of a woman who's birthing, first, you know, you need to accredit the person who took the photograph, but you also need to get permission of the woman.
Yes.
It always makes me a bit uneasy, the amount. I mean, it's great that there's lots of amazing pictures of women being shared, but I do sometimes wonder if the woman knows that
I'm assuming they do. And I'm assuming the ones where you go on iStock or Pixabay and places where they'll have a certain amount of free images.
Well, those are copyright. So it can be frustrating when you're trying to teach and you want to share things that you know would help with teaching, and you can't get them copyright free. But I think I'm actually going to include a little bit of this law and ethics stuff in my next course, because we don't get it in midwifery. Yeah. We don't. And there's like a lot of things that you wouldn't even think of. Like for example, lending libraries actually breach copyright. So libraries, we'll link a blog post by Sarah Wickham about this stuff, because I actually link to her stuff in my course. At the beginning of my course, I kind of say, look, this is copyright, and you know, you can share this, you can't share that. And I actually link to her stuff because it's pretty clear. So for example, like libraries buy a book, and then you get a certain amount of money every time somebody borrows a book from a library. And you obviously get royalties when a book gets sold.
Oh, I didn't know that about the libraries. I always wondered how that worked, and money-wise for the author.
Yeah, so they basically pay the author for the loans because somebody's getting the book. Yeah. But if you are offering libraries part of a service, and we've probably all done it when we were private midwives or whatever, or, oh, I've got a library and you can, part of my services is that you can borrow books out of my library as part of my service, that's now breaching copyright and law.
Ooh, big topic.
I know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Good question.
So that's interesting that, that's been brought up because it probably does need to be in midwifery education. You do law and ethics in midwifery. There's a whole lot of law and ethics in midwifery education, but not about that, not about copyright.
And it's what we need now because it's, we have so much and so many possibilities to be sharing where we may be on grey or like in the red. As in, not allowed.
But it's good because we want sharing. We want the information to get out there and circulate and can and get to the right people. But it's how you do that legally and ethically.
Good question. Blimey.
Hmm. Again, it could have been a podcast. So do you want to, where are we at? Is it your turn or my turn? Your turn.
Me.
Yeah. Oh, okay. This is a good one. Breastfeeding in pregnancy. I don't know what they want about breastfeeding and pregnancy, but breastfeeding and pregnancy.
So basically I've taken this as a bit like the main points. Can you breastfeed while you're pregnant? The short answer for the majority of women is yes, absolutely. What tends to happen is the first thing you will notice is possibly your nipples start to feel quite sore. Sometimes this is the first reason women realize that, oh my gosh, I think I'm pregnant again because this is starting to hurt. And so you might have some soreness of the nipples for a few weeks. Often if it's you're still breastfeeding a toddler, they may go off for a few weeks and they'll quite happily come back on to breastfeed again. The other thing is that during around about 16 to 20 weeks, this is when you start to produce colostrum. And so that happens even when you're breastfeeding another child, your body is still pregnant. So it's going to go through these natural changes. And
so does the milk change for the baby that's feeding?
Yes. And so what happens is it can change in flavor because there's more sodium. So it becomes more salty. So colostrum is sweet, but it's more salty than, say, mature milk. And so, again, sometimes the baby that's breastfeeding whilst the brother or sister is growing will suddenly go, ugh, what is this? Like, this milk's horrible. They might get quite annoyed as well. Depends on the age of them. And, again, they might then stop breastfeeding and come back. Or maybe that will be the end of this breastfeeding relationship. For some mums and their child at that time. It just depends. And sometimes, you know, like I've said, and I always say, and we all, you know, anyone in our world says, it's not just about the milk. I mean, the milk's bloody important, but it's the comfort and the love and being close and that bonding. There are some contraindications, but for a small majority of women. So this would be women who've got an obstetric history of loss, of pregnancy loss, miscarriage, particularly late miscarriage. Then it's like...
Why would that be?
Pardon?
Is it because it could, is that because it could get contractions going?
Potentially. Like and the thing is that we don't know and we can't say... Yes, it's definitely going to happen. Or in these studies, X amount of women. I mean, we don't really have a lot of women who are breastfeeding long term. You know, it's such small percentages in high income countries. And what we also don't have is, you know, there's a bit of a stigma of breastfeeding beyond 6 months or a year or 18 months still. And a lot of women don't say that they're still breastfeeding when they come to their booking in visit for fear of being judged. And that's an actual thing that's happened. And I've been told that a lot in my career of seeing women as well. And they kind of feel like they go, they've checked me out. And when I've had a breastfeeding discussion during that booking in, and then they open up and disclose their terrible secret. And it's like, isn't that terrible? And I've experienced that so much that I think that must be happening quite a lot. And I find that really, it's really sad. Like, of course, my first thing is like, bloody marvelous. Like, however long you're able to breastfeed depends on so many circumstances. But the last thing I'm going to do that is say, well, you shouldn't be breastfeeding now. There's so many reasons for longer term breastfeeding. It's not pointless. It's, you know, that's a podcast. We know there's point to it. We've just talked about that the evolutionary age is years of age. So some contraindications would be placenta previa. You've had previous losses, late miscarriages. You're having any bleeding in pregnancy, or you've already been told to not have sex during pregnancy because they think there might be a risk to the pregnancy. And that is because every time the baby feeds, you release small amounts of oxytocin. And we know that they're small amounts because they tend not to cause contractions. However, for certain women who are considered, this is a fairly high risk pregnancy, that would be a case when they would probably advise, or they would advise you to stop breastfeeding. Now, obviously, this is an individual thing and needs to be discussed with your obstetrician and the midwife. And also, I think it needs to be discussed with the midwife because it's a real psychological thing, like particularly if you're breastfeeding an 18-month-old, it's not as easy as just going, right, tomorrow we're not breastfeeding anymore. There's a lot of psychological aspects around that. And I know I'm skimming over this, but it is important to talk that through. It can be a real grief to stop breastfeeding for some women, especially when they've been doing it for a long time. And the other thing that's really can be really lovely is breastfeeding in pregnancy when you don't have the sore nipples, the baby's not going, it tastes horrible, or the child's not doing that, and we haven't told you to stop breastfeeding, is that it can really form this kind of bond between you, the siblings. And then when, if you continue to breastfeed when the new baby is born, it's called tandem feeding. And the first thing is that obviously the colostrum is really going to be much smaller in quantity. And we really want to put the new baby on first. But once you've got your milks transitioning and you're getting mature milk, your body's just going to learn to make enough for both babies, whatever their demands are, because, or both children, I should say, because it's supply and demand. So it's not like you won't have enough for the baby. And what can actually be really helpful is when you have, say, a toddler who's breastfeeding, often, you know, your milk comes in or the volume increases much quicker. They're really good at clearing out blocked ducts because they're more efficient. So it can have all these little moments that actually really help you. And also, you know, you get these beautiful stories and pick photos, talking of photos, of mums who are breastfeeding, say, an 18-month-old and feeding a new baby, and just like the baby and the older sibling are holding hands and then looking up at mum, and it, it's just gorgeous.
They'll be fighting. 5 years' time, they'll be fighting.
Absolutely. They'll hate each other's guts when they're in 10 years' time, 15 years' time. However, that period can be a real nice transition for the toddler who's suddenly got to share mummy. And and that can be really nice as well. So it definitely, this is a bigger topic. There's huge amounts that you can read online, but you do not have to stop breastfeeding because you've become pregnant. That's the main key answer for this. There you go.
Thanks.
Right. Okay, Rachel, question for you. How do they check the placenta is working from scans?
Okay, so it's not just from a normal scan. It's a very specific kind of scan that they do. And it's actually looking at the umbilical, so it's an umbilical arterial Doppler assessment. And I don't know, have you ever seen one done?
Yes.
Yeah. And so what they end up getting, and I am not a technician, and this is
not within my scope, but I've sat with women having this done, is they're looking at the blood flow through the umbilical artery. And it ends up like doing this little form wave, doesn't it? Like a pattern wave. And if that is basically telling you the effective blood flow to the baby.
Yeah.
And whether or not there's good enough blood flow going through from the placenta to the baby. So that's how they need to be doing it. So it's not just the usual scan. It's a really specific scan. And if there's any concerns about the baby, that's what needs to be done. So they'll do that for growth restricted babies, or they should do it. If people are thinking a baby's too small, you can't tell that by a scan. Scan's useless for, you know, the size of a baby. Two, the baby might just be, you know, genetically small. So in order to find out whether or not this is a growth restricted baby, a baby who is not getting adequate oxygen, you need to look at the umbilical arterial Doppler flow. So that's how they do it.
Perfect. Perfect answer. And I didn't interrupt you.
You didn't. And you see, I put that in because it then feeds onto the next.
Your question.
The next questions. Yeah.
Well, then let's ask that question because then it makes sense. Is there another way to check the placenta position rather than scans?
Well, one of the things that is routinely looked for on ultrasound is the position of where the placenta is. Usually placentas are in the fundus, so at the top of the uterus. Sometimes they're not, but that's where they usually are. Sometimes they're on the side or the front or the back or wherever. And it doesn't really matter as long as they're not over the cervix, which is the next question. So you can get an idea. If you've got a placenta that's at the front rather than at the top and at the back, then you might know that the woman might notice that she's not feeling the baby's kicks as obviously as maybe a previous pregnancy. It's like through a doona.
Yep. Wait, hold on. Not everyone knows what doona is. Remember, that's a very Australian word. Duvet. Duvet.
A duvet.
Yes.
For those in the UK.
Yes.
Or a doona for those in Australia. You see, I've learned the correct Australian term.
Ah. So I was writing a fact sheet and I had written duvet. For something, and someone had corrected it as doona, and I was like, what the hell is this? This is not even English.
I know.
And then I realized, oh yeah, I have to work right in Australian. Didn't realize it was another dialect. And it's taken me ages to start saying duvet and not doona. Anyway.
Well, I say now. Anyway.
It's like you're feeling the kicks through the duvet, the doona.
Yeah. So the woman might notice that it feels different to another pregnancy and know that her placenta is on the front. Or should I just know that? Some women just know where their placentas are. You can get an idea from the outside of the woman.
Mm.
Yes, by doing a scan, but by doing palpation, you can actually you're feeling the baby through the doona if it's at the front.
Yeah.
Of the uterus. Yeah. And when you listen in, nobody uses pinnods anymore, which is one of my bugbears, because you need to use a pinnod because then you're actually hearing the baby's heartbeat, not the Doppler bouncing sound, you know.
Yeah.
Ultrasound waves and creating something. But even with the Doppler, it'll be difficult to hear the clack, clack, clack of the baby's heartbeat because you're listening through the placenta. So instead you'll have this whoosh, 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 whoosh sound, which you can get anyway when you're using a Doppler. You can sometimes pick up the placental flow anyway, but it'll be much more difficult to get like behind the placenta to get the clack, 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 clack. So you go, dead. So that's now with placenta pre, which is the next question. So I'll answer that one at the same time.
I think you should.
You want us to chat more on placenta previa?
We'll just chat along about placenta previa. This is a whole podcast, man.
So with placenta previa, which is actually what they're looking for on scan, unfortunately, nowadays they're doing ultrasound and then reporting on all kinds of things that just stress people out that got like no, there's no point in knowing the things that they're telling women about their placentas because they don't mean anything. You know, so it doesn't matter if the placenta's at the front, unless you've got a scar from a previous cesarean, and it's embedded right there, which is quite low down, which is really unusual to have a low placenta at the front. So placenta previa is basically when the placenta is very close to or over the cervix. And I actually looked up the Latin for this because I thought, I'll bet this has got a Latin thing. So previa is a combination of two words, which is pre or pre, meaning before, and via, meaning way. So it's basically in front of, it's in the way of.
Of course.
The baby coming through.
Via. It's via, not via.
Yeah.
Because that's what they call in Italian this via del da-da-da-da, which is like the street, the way.
Previa. So what you're saying is previa.
Yeah. Via. No, via. It's via. Anyway, my Italian's not great, but it's Latin, isn't it? But I mean, I went to Italy and I saw that everything was something via. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, it's like in the street name. So that makes sense. It's the way. It's before the way. It's in the way.
It's in the way.
It's in the way of the cervix.
The placenta's in the
way of the hole that's going to open and get out the baby, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's unusual for it to embed there because it's not, it hasn't got as rich a, you know, the fundus is where all the like juicy blood
juicy
flow
blood
is and the
flow,
big
all the nutrients going
the
in.
To get yourself kind of embedded into that lining. And anyway, so sometimes placentas end up embedding low down. So then you've got the problem that's fine when the cervix is closed. But once the cervix starts to shift and change, which it does before labor, starts to soften and get ready to be pulled up by the fundus, that can disrupt the blood vessels. That's really, we need a film of that.
You need that for your course. I am doing the uterus.
You look a bit like an orangutan.
Your favorite. Just doing it for you. You said the O word. Wow, Rachel, well done. You're coming well.
You look like
the therapy's going well.
Shut up. Let me finish placentas before I lose what I'm talking about. Right. What am I talking about? Placentas. Right. So if it's over the cervix, then when things change in the cervix, getting ready for labor and birth, it can disrupt the blood vessels. And there's a huge amount of blood going to a placenta and there's blood circulating through placenta. So if you disrupt those blood vessels, you're going to bleed. And you're going to bleed pretty badly, potentially. So that's why everybody gets worried about placenta previa, because in the past, women died. You know, it was you would just die because your cervix would start to open, blood vessels would tear, and you'd hemorrhage before before the baby was even born. So it is a genuine complication of pregnancy. Luckily, very rare, and I don't know the stats on the top of my head, but my guess would be like less than 1%. Mm. That would be my guess. I'll have to go and look that up and I'll be completely wrong. But anyway, don't reference me on that one. So an ultrasound scan will tell you that the placenta is low and then everybody gets worried, but it actually gets, as the uterus grows and stretches with the pregnancy, the placenta gets pulled up. I'm sorry, was those ding? Do you want the dingings turned off?
Look at your face. Read.
Oh, I'm getting messages telling me that it's...
Turn your bloody sound off. How many podcasts have we done? Jesus.
Right, well, I don't know how to turn it off on my...
Right,
computer.
But you interrupted yourself there.
Without...
So...
Right, placenta previa. Where was I? So when the pregnancy grows and the uterus gets pulled and stretched up, the placenta appears to move, but placentas don't move. It's just that the bit that they're attached onto gets pulled up. We really do need to do a drawing or a visual, don't we, for that? It gets pulled up and usually gets pulled up out of the way of that cervix. So even if it's low-lying in pregnancy, it'll move. So the problem is a placenta that's low-lying and is very low-lying and stays low-lying becomes a problem. So then the question is, do you know that without a scan? Well, most women who've got a placenta like that will have an idea they've got a placenta like that before anything happens. So for example, that the baby won't be able to get into the pelvis because the placenta's in the pelvis, so they'll have quite a high baby in their uterus because there's the placenta, they're sitting on their placenta. So they can't get in there. They'll also maybe start to have bleeds as, right, that's a big warning sign. If you're starting to have like fresh bleeding at the end of pregnancy, that's not normal. And that's something worth looking out for. So you can usually find out without a scan. You'll get, but you might not. So, you know, the women that I've cared for women who have chosen not to have scans, and that's entirely up to them. And there are there's really two things to consider if your risks, I guess, if you're choosing not to have a scan, but a lot of women find that the risks of the scan outweigh these. One is that you have a baby with a congenital abnormality that you weren't expecting. Mm-hmm. And again, scans often miss abnormalities, and they overdiagnose. False positives are really common. But, you know, you could have a baby that has something significant wrong with the baby that you're not aware of, and you birth in a setting where you haven't got medical backup that you might need. That's pretty unlikely. And the other one is that you've got a placenta over your cervix that you have no signs of, and all of a sudden you just start hemorrhaging, which is, again, really unlikely, because you would usually get some little warning signs. But, you know, it's worth considering that. And if a woman's not having ultrasounds, then, you know, there's risks with everything. There's risks either way. There is no risk-free way to do anything. It's pick the risks you want. And a lot of women I've cared for have picked those risks, those really unlikely risks, over the risks of what they perceive the risks of an ultrasound.
Yep. Good answer.
I managed to get 3-in-1 there, didn't I?
You did. Is there a thing for that? 3-in-1? Triple? No, probably not. Should I ask the question of what is risks of scans, or is that just too massive to discuss?
That's too massive to discuss, and I'm really not all over that. Sarah M. Buckley has written about that. So if you're really interested, do a search for Sarah Buckley ultrasound. I think it's on her website.
All right. Actually, she has. I've read it. Okay.
Yeah. Can I ask you one?
Yeah.
Postpartum pain with sex, and maybe sexual drive declining when breastfeeding, and why?
Yeah, this is a good question. And your face, are you just reading or are you looking at me like that? You look like a school mom, like, This is an interesting question, and something I don't think we talk a lot about when it comes to breastfeeding, or we don't talk enough about, because, you know, you're surrounded by these hormones, particularly the hormone prolactin. And prolactin is very much this kind of nesting, mothering hormone. It also promotes a fair bit of anxiety that is needed in order to be, you know, the mama elephant of this protection. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And it's like there's a certain amount of anxiety in terms of you know, we're designed to sleep with our babies, evolutionarily. We don't wrap them like a burrito and put them in a plastic cot. But so we're designed evolutionarily to sleep with our babies, and we want to be alert to the baby. So this prolactin hormone allows for this, so that we don't completely sleep through any of their waking. Oxytocin also is in part for that, but it just gives us this little bit of anxiety. It really gives us this kind of motheringness, but it also reduces libido. So, and the other thing it can do is cause a reduction in vaginal lubrication sometimes. So
I did not know this.
There you go. So this is something we really don't talk about. And I would like to bring someone on to talk about this much more in detail, who is
an expert. Think we could do a whole podcast.
Definitely whole podcast. And I want to bring someone on. But touching on it, I think, is important to mention, because often women who are breastfeeding, you know, women who are discharged from the from the hospital system, you know, what's one of the things we have to talk to women about?
Well, contraception, for God's sake.
So in terms of our culture, we're already instilling and often talking about it in front of a partner that you will be going back to a sex life within 6 weeks or sooner, and you should be feeling absolutely hunky-dory. Well, don't take away, but also we've got all the things of, have you had tearing? Have you had an episiotomy? What type of birth? How are you feeling traumatized? The psychological aspects. But breastfeeding itself is there because the mother is really totally at the needs of the baby. And this is what is the design. Where problems start to often come into our, say, you know, Western high-income culture in particular, and most cultures predominantly, we're in kind of monogamous society as the norm, one partner, is that a mother can feel lack of libido. She's, one, exhausted often, and she's not necessarily up for it. But every woman is different, obviously. And it's just like when some women go, I do not want any sex during pregnancy, or I never wanted sex during my pregnancy. And other ones are like, I am a horny monster and I cannot get enough. We're all different. The other thing I want to mention here is that there's a thing known as touched out. If you Google that and you may have experienced it, you may be listening to this and experiencing it now. And really it's that time when, you know, this baby needs you constantly and you're constantly being touched with the baby. And there are these feelings of almost like, can someone just not touch me for a while? Like, I don't want to be held. I don't want to be a hand on my shoulder by my partner. I just need some space because it's constant. And then we have this battle of the guilt and how we're feeling, how we're treating our partner, the guilt towards, actually, I really don't want to breastfeed right now. And that can come with longer term breastfeeding, or it can be sooner for some women as well. And this is a legitimate feeling that should be honored. And it's really quite normal. And again, if you think back to how we would have been in sort of cavewoman society, or even in tribal society.
For me to tell you, our teacups
and nice little cucumber sandwiches with no crusts. That was my cave. Hell yes. I make sure there's a gluten-free chocolate brownie for you and me as well when you come round. But we would have, you know, we had our babies much younger. We had much more support. We would have had time out in terms of people to take the baby and hold the baby. In society now, we're often on our own. Partner might go back to work. We don't have sisters and mothers and friends there all the time that we're swapping the children, and it's that society. And another thing that's really important is they've seen in some men who are really involved with the parenting from very early on and very centered around the baby, it can also reduce a man's libido, if we're talking about the man as the partner, because
their testosterone reduces after birth.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we can also see that. And often, because this isn't talked about much, it's like, is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with my partner? You know, there's some research, you know, where women will say, I don't want to be seen as a mother all the time, but he's such a great dad. But then why doesn't he want me? Or does he not want me because I've changed my body? And of course, our body shapes change. They're meant to. They hold on to this, you know, these fat reserves for a reason, to feed this baby. And we talk about breastfeeding and weight loss, but it's not always overnight. And it's not meant to happen. Also, you know, with rapid weight loss, this can change the fatty acid profile. And it's not actually great for the baby and the milk, but that's a whole other podcast. So a lot of these questions are a whole other podcast. We're just doing a snippet.
That's what we call this podcast.
So that is the short version of why many women are actually not feeling like I'm up for it. It's hormonal based. It's changing your libido. It's changing possibly your vaginal secretions. You're really in this whole mothering, nesting. Your whole body is designed to be there for the baby. You've got slight anxiety or even kind of like this mother aggression protectiveness, which is normal. And you're bloody knackered and the psychological pressure. So there's my answer.
Excellent.
Thanks. So, last question for you, Rachel. And clearly, we're not going to fit through all of our questions. I did think we would when there was like 16 that we'd brought them down to. Rachel, can I have your thoughts on Kiko, knees in, calves out as a birthing position?
I could do a whole podcast on birthing position.
No, really?
My thoughts probably aren't going to be very popular. My thoughts are, with physiological birth, as I wrote extensively in my book, the birth position is part of a birth dance between mother and baby, and there's no prescription. There's no... Can you hear him whinging in the background?
No.
Sorry.
I'm loving it.
Really? I'm bloody talking.
Just recording a podcast. It's so professional today. Holy shitballs.
Where was I?
I don't know. Knees in, Kiko.
Right. So the whole point about physiological birth is that the woman is connected with her body and her baby and is instinctively moving into whatever position is right for her particular baby and her particular body in order to birth the baby, which can look like a whole load of different things. Like it will, you know, there are some general themes in that, you know, most women will get into a forward leaning position. If nobody's there to catch the baby, most women will then kind of sit backwards. Like I've, you know, my logo for my childbirth physiology course. That's why I picked that logo, because that is the classic woman catching her own baby in a physiological birth. So when we start telling women, oh, no, you need to be on your knees over the, because that was the, you know, that was a craze, I guess, when we were training, was on all fours, get everybody on all fours, get on all fours, get on all fours, get on the bed, like, God's sake. Because what's happened is medicalization of birth has involved so many interventions and so many directions, because there's a lack of trust in the woman and her body. Okay. So then we're trying to reclaim that. And often what we do in reclaiming it is we just send the same message in a different language. So instead of saying you need expertise outside of yourself and knowledge outside of yourself to understand how to birth your baby, and I have a white coat and I'm a doctor and I can teach you that, we're now saying there are, you know, we're doing it from a natural perspective. That you need to breathe a particular way, you need to have a particular position, like on all fours or Kiko, which, yeah, may actually generally increase the outlet of the pelvis. But these things are great for women who've got epidurals, who are having a medicalized birth, who are struggling to connect in with their body and their baby, or who are not having a physiological birth, so it's kind of not, it's disrupted already, then yeah, absolutely go for it. Do all of your, you know, using Rebozo or whatever it is, or do all of your special tricks. But when you've got a woman who's physiologically birthing, she doesn't require preparation. She doesn't require particular positions. And one of the risks of teaching women positions in pregnancy is they think they need to get into them when they're birthing, and they're using their brain, not connecting with their body. So they're intellectually getting into a position, not following what it is their body needs to do. So that's my long position on it. It's probably a great position, but I don't think we should be telling women that they should be in any particular birth position.
Oh, hell yes. Couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Brilliant. Love it. It's my position as well. I loved how you kept using the word position. I just wanted to go in and be like, look, all these puns she's using, position afterwards.
Position. And I actually forgot how to say the word position when I was doing my audiobook.
Oh, brilliant.
I actually couldn't pronounce it. You know, when you've said something so many times, you're position. And I kept having to stop and say to the bloke who's recording it, like, am I saying position properly? And he's like, laughing. He's going, And he's saying, yeah, but like, you're not saying, and then tell me all these other words that I was saying in a Geordie accent that were wrong. It's like, no, like, that's how I say that word, but I can't say position.
Position. I've only had 12 gins.
Anyway, right, come on, your last question, and then we can go, and I can go and help with whatever the hell's going on.
Acting like this, because I can't edit this when you're like, your last question, and blah, blah, blah.
Why can't you edit it?
You're going to hate this episode. You're not going to accept it. I'm not even going to put it to you for pre-approval.
I put it to you. Right. Are you ready? I am pretty sure we've done this one before, so this will be quick. Do you need to prepare your nipples for breastfeeding, toughening them up in pregnancy to avoid pain?
No. No. That's it. That's the end of the questions. No.
So it's a bit like the vagina examinations. The vagina examinations? Nope.
No.
Toughening up nipples? Nope.
No. No evidence for it. Nope. Don't hurt yourself. Don't get any scrubbing brushes, wire brushes, anything. Just be kind. Nipples need kindness, okay? They're going to have some serious...
And they prepare themselves. Just like cervixes prepare themselves.
They do, because your whole body is changing and the hormones are changing things, and they're preparing themselves to breastfeed. So leave them alone, which we used to do for eons. And then we come along, or man comes along and wants to do something, and we feel like we have to do something. So it's old wives' tales from 1900s bullshit. And just leave your nipples alone. If you want to prepare, it is go and discuss what's going on if you think you've got flat inverted nipples or extra large nipples, or what is considered extra large. Or if you have unusual shaped nipples, two different shaped nipples, if you have an extra nipple that's growing on the side. So that might cause some challenges, I would say, not necessarily difficulties, but challenges for the baby's mouth or positioning. And so if you are not necessarily, if you're like most people who are not the the image of breasts that we see everywhere, because most women don't fit that mold, I must say, after seeing thousands of breasts, then talk to your midwife during pregnancy. And that doesn't mean she has to touch or hands on or do anything nasty. But I do think we've lost the art of actually discussing the changes that are going through in pregnancy, in terms of the darkening of the nipple, the areola, that reassurance. And I think we should still be doing that and asking those questions. Some women have extra nipples. You're going to have like up to 8 nipples. Lots of women might have them just underneath their breast, another nipple, and it can even produce milk. Or you might have it in your armpit. Those types of things are nothing to keep secret. You're not a freak of nature. They're really common, actually. Well, not really common, but they're fairly common, and they are not going to shock your midwife. And if they do, go and see a breastfeeding specialist. And that way you can feel more comfortable, more ready for breastfeeding, and reduce the anxiety. And it might mean that we need to look at specific positions to help you out with breastfeeding, but that's really it. That's the preparation you need to do, not toughening up your nipples with horrible, you know, wiry towels and leave them alone. There we go. That's it. I think that's all we've got time for today. The rest of your questions are going to be full podcasts. And thank you so much for sending them in. I hope you have had a question answered. I hope this has given you some more insight into these areas, and some of them we will expand on and bring in some experts to expand a bit further, which is going to be fascinating.
Once we capture them.
We've got, oh yeah, get the butterfly net out. Also, can I wear the khakis? You know, like with the big, what are those, like helmets for archaeologists? Definitely. Oh man, no thanks. Okay, we're going to go about it the normal way, by emails or finding people. So thank you very much, Rachel, for joining me today, despite the...
It's been a pleasure.
...grumpiness. I don't think it's been a pleasure. I don't think you've been very happy to see me. And also, thanks, really, for joining me and making loads of noise in the background.
I'm scared.
signing off. That's it, folks.
Well, we hope you found some lovely gold nuggets in this episode. Please do take them away and tell your friends about how good it is inside the cauldron. There's plenty of room, so bring them in. Once again, and as I say every episode, please go and tell them wonderful podcast hosting platforms what you think of our goldeny, nuggety goodness. Every comment left helps us to start the conversation in another hospital, with another birth worker, and for another woman. You can also support us to make more shows by donating to our Patreon page. All details on how to do this are in the show notes, as well as over on our Instagram page at The Midwives Cauldron. Thank you to all of you for your ongoing support. We are so thrilled to have you with us. Please keep telling your friends and sharing your stories about us, and we will see you next time. And of course, here are this episode's bloopers.
Did it some
right,
point.
So just so you know, listeners, because clearly you're still listening, I haven't edited all of that, Raj, because it's not possible. It's not possible to edit when you then, I cut it and you go, so just say, da-da-da-da-da. That's not possible to cut and make it sound lovely, so you're going to have the Rajin.
I'm sure it
if
is
you start
to
again
cut.
And it's nice, then I can cut it. But not when you go, just so. I can't cut that. I can't change the tone of your voice. Just leave it in. It's fine. Leave it in. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and lactation, the fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.